Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. President Trump has just met with top automobile executives. Before the meeting, he tweeted, "I want new plants to be built here for cars sold here." At a meeting with other business leaders yesterday, he issued this threat to those who move jobs abroad and then try to sell their products in the United States.
If that happens, we are going to be imposing a very major border tax on the product when it comes in, which I think is fair, So a company that wants to fire all of its people in the United States and build some factory someplace else and then thinks that that product is going to just flow across the border into the United States, that's not going to happen. They're going to have a tax to pay, a border tax, a substantial border tax.
So the economic populist Trump is now in office, and he won praise yesterday from some union leaders who had endorsed Hillary Clinton, Rust Belt Democrats, and Senator Bernie Sanders, who also put pressure on Trump to practice what he preaches after Trump canceled the TPP trade agreement yesterday.
Yes, I am very glad that he is ending that. But what has to happen now are two additional factors. Number one, Mr. Trump right now owns factories in countries like Bangladesh, Mexico, China, and Turkey, where he's paying workers abroad very low wages. Now, Mr. Trump, during his inaugural, said he believes in Buy American, hire American workers. Well, if he believes in that, he could set a great example by bringing those jobs back to the United States of America and hiring American workers here. Second point is, it's one thing to kill the TPP, which is a positive step, in my view. It's another thing to develop a trade policy which finally works for American workers and not the CEOs of large multinational corporations. And if Mr. Trump is serious about moving in that direction, I would be delighted to work with him.
Bernie Sanders on CNN last night. By the way, Anderson Cooper corrected him slightly that Donald Trump doesn't own those plants overseas, but they do make some of his and his daughter's clothing line products, just making that correction clear. Obviously, Sanders and the Rust Belt Democrats don't like other things Trump has done in office already, like lying again yesterday about winning the popular vote if it weren't for voter fraud, and canceling all U.S. aid to developing country health providers if they even mention to a woman with an unwanted pregnancy that abortion is an option. Let's talk about all of this with the Monday night host of our new national call-in show, Indivisible, which premiered last night, Kai Wright, who was features editor and a writer for The Nation magazine before joining WNYC recently, and John Prideaux, who is U.S. editor for The Economist. Hi, Kai. Hi, John. Congratulations on a great launch last night with your callers from so many states.
Thank you, John. Or thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
And listeners, just for the record, I'm the Tuesday night host, so join me tonight at 8 if you're interested. Fareed Zakaria and Michael Moore will be my guests, plus more callers from everywhere. Tonight at 8 here on WNYC. Again, the new show is called Indivisible. John, since you're with The Economist, I'll direct my first economics question to you. How is The Economist reporting for your global readership or your UK readership on this pressure on U.S. companies to make products here if they're going to be sold here? Domestically, he's got the both the populist right and a bit of the populist left in a rare display of agreement.
Yeah, that's incredibly interesting. I think the clips you played from Senator Sanders just showing what a huge change we've had in American politics, not just a Republican president, but a Republican president who seems to agree on many economic matters with the candidate who lost the Democratic primary, in part because many people thought he was too far to the left. It's very interesting, this overlap between the kind of Trump view of economics and the Sanders view. In terms of how we've been reporting it, we actually have more readers in the US than we have elsewhere in the world. So we're very focused on what all this means for American business. And some of the companies we talk to say, well, Trump's going to bring a tax cut for companies. He's going to bring deregulation. There's going to be growth. So, yeah, he's going to bully companies a little bit, but we can sort of suck it up. And some companies, I think, are more worried and also see that, you know, America doesn't operate in isolation. If Donald Trump pursues the policies he's been talking about, you know, other countries will go down the same route and the world will end up poorer as a result.
In fact, to amplify something you just said, that stick is half the equation only, threatening to hit companies with big tariffs if they try to bring their products in after moving jobs out. I have some audio that's brand new from after that meeting with the auto executives yesterday, and he talked about reduced regulation and tax cuts. Here's 6 seconds.
I think you're going to find this to be from very inhospitable to extremely hospitable.
Talking about the business environment and on the environment.
I am, to a large extent, an environmentalist. I believe in it. But it's out of control.
So, listeners, if you're revolted by Trump in general, maybe you attended one of the marches this weekend, how much does it complicate your view of him if he's breaking with Republican Party precedent and pressuring, not just coddling, CEOs, or react to anything else coming out of the new administration? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. So, Kai, as someone who usually writes about race and culture and finds Trump so troubling on so many levels, are you cringing at Bernie Sanders saying he's, quote, delighted to work with him on these kinds of issues? Do you think it hurts the fight for other kinds of equality? Or are you okay with Democrats just taking their alliances issue by issue if they can advance economic justice here and there?
Well, I mean, I think we should be clear about what Bernie Sanders said. I mean, so going back for some time, the left in general and labor in specific and in his campaign, Sanders have been saying these trade deals are bad for American workers, period. And they're also, by the way, bad for workers around the world because it's a race to the bottom for labor everywhere.
But Republicans weren't saying that, and President Obama wasn't saying that.
No, he wasn't. And centrist Democrats were not saying that. But the left and labor and Bernie Sanders have long been saying that and opposing TPP. And I think what is important here is for the Trump administration is the question between the difference between rhetoric and action. And that was Sanders' point, and I think it's the crucial one, right? Like many people will agree these trade deals are bad. The question is what comes after them. And I think when you hear critics of the administration talk about the economic policy, they say, fine, that's great. He's railing against these trade deals. He says he wants to renegotiate them. But then he's appointing this cabinet of billionaire kleptocrats. And so which one of these two things is going to be the administration? And I think that is the question before us. It's not so much that there's been a meaningful shift from labor or the left or Sanders, it's what is this administration going to be? Is it going to be this rhetoric on trade or is it going to be the action of these
guys? Right. Time will tell. And Sanders brought up the interesting practice, what you preach, pushback of things that are sold by Trump companies, clothing, for example, that are themselves made by cheap labor overseas. Do you think that could become a major political pushing point?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's something that the Democrats tried to push during the campaign. It did not work. so I don't know how much that will stick. But I think what you're hearing a lot from Democratic leaders, and that will be interesting to see how it resonates with Trump supporters, is again this difference between what he has said and what so far he has actually done in terms of cabinet appointments. Those are the only things he has done, and they do not match up with the rhetoric. And so the question, I think you'll see a lot of push to try to show that there's a difference between this rhetoric and this action, and we'll see whether that matters.
And John Prideaux from The Economist, we even now have the big iPhone maker Foxconn, which has those famously low-paying factories in China, saying they might open a plant in the U.S. to make display panels. I guess that's like flat screens. And create up to 50,000 U.S. jobs. It sounds too good to believe. Do you believe it?
It does sound too good to believe. And obviously, when companies say they're going to stay in the U.S., that's a cause for celebration. When Foxconn says it's going to bring manufacturing to the U.S., that would be good. I think one of the things that potentially we all miss here with this story is that President Trump, to some extent, is fighting the last fight. He's focused on trade and threats to American jobs from trade. Obviously, there are losers from trade. There are also more winners, which is why it's made America kind of rich over the past couple of centuries. But the thing that he doesn't talk about, and I don't think he has an answer for yet, is automation. So one of the things that I think his presidency risks, if it goes down the route we're seeing, is that manufacturing companies substitute, you know, kind of machines for labor faster than they would have otherwise. And so, you know, some of the stuff he's saying, I don't think is going to have the effect that he thinks it's going to have. It's more likely to make companies say, OK, we'll have our manufacturing in Wisconsin, but we're going to have a lot more machines and a lot fewer people.
Yeah. Do you think it's that there's any way to say don't hire robots? He can say don't move your human jobs to Mexico and then try to import your products. Is there any way to say don't hire so many robots?
I don't think there is. And I think part of it is to do with our relationship with technology. We all sort of like technology. You know, we like the iPhone in our pocket and so forth. And I don't think, you know, it's possible to run a campaign against robots in the same way that it's possible to run a campaign against foreigners or, you know, or immigrants taking jobs. So, you know, that's my view on that one.
Nora, did you want to add something, Kai?
I don't want to cut off Nora. Let's hear from
her. All right. Nora in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Yeah, I was just listening on the phone to what you all were saying. And I do think I voted for Bernie Sanders, and I then voted for Hillary. But I am very open to Trump being able, if he follows up on what he was actually saying, and it's not just rhetoric, as you all were saying, follow up on trying to do something to rebalance the way our economy functions. And I think that what people don't talk about is that this is a worldwide problem. And you were just saying, oh, will people ever, you know, give up on robots? And you say, well, I like my iPhone. On the other hand, it's a moral choice. And at a certain point, someone might have to look at someone and say, either you have a job or I give up on my robot. And then what happens? And I think that Trump, oddly enough, because I think that his morals in many ways are reprehensible, is trying to shame these people into having a moral take on an economic situation.
Kai?
I think that's exactly right. And I think a lot of people are where Nora is in terms of what Trump is trying to do, at least in terms of his public contribution, right? He's trying to actively shame companies into behaving differently. I think, though, that for me, it's less about robots being the what we should be debating. It's more about this whole discussion over manufacturing jobs in general. It is the wrong fight, right? I mean, when we're talking about the people's jobs, the reality is that now and probably into the future, the vast majority of jobs are service sector jobs, and the debate that I would like to hear more from labor, from Democrats, and from Trump is what are we going to do to improve service sector jobs, because those are the jobs that people have.
And they tend to pay so much less and come without health benefits and things like that compared to the old manufacturing
right,
jobs?
Right. And there's no creed from God that says that has to be so, right? That is the economy we've built. And so how do we move forward such that we build a different economy with jobs that people have that are better jobs?
Rita, on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rita.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much. A great show.
Thanks.
My question is, could you please start introducing the cost-to-consumer side of Trump's selecting specific industries? Because what we need to recognize is that prices will go up. Most likely for consumers. So you have a new job, but you'll be paying more for your new car, et cetera. The other thing I'd like to ask is, could you please bring in the history of earlier protectionist, protectionist laws like Hoot-Smalley and how it contributed to depression, economic depression in Europe, and potentially the rise of Hitler, because he was going to solve all those economic problems
right,
in Germany,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah, both good questions. And it was not Hoot-Smalley, it was Smoot-Hawley. But I like the sound of Hoot-Smalley better, actually.
Sorry.
It's kind of got an edgy wing to it. But seriously, John, she raises the question of if Trump is pressuring companies to keep more jobs in the United States, to make things that we buy here that pay people more than, you know, they're going to pay people in Mexico or China or wherever, then those products are going to cost more. And that's something that the public has to be rooting for or willing to accept alongside the other, you know, good of the jobs as part of the package, right?
Yeah, I think Rita has a very sound grasp, but not only of economics, but of the kind of politics of trade, which are that you get a lot of winners because prices become lower, but you get concentrated losses. So you have a factory that shuts and people who are very angry about that. And the politics of that tend to favour the concentrated losses, you know, the people who've been thrown out of a job. And, you know, that's understandable, clearly, on a human level. On the history of protectionism and Smoot-Hawley, yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's the reason why America, for the past, you know, kind of 60 years, has been pushing open trade deals around the world, because it doesn't just make America richer, it makes the world richer. And what's certainly the case is once one country, you know, particularly a big, important country like America, starts pulling back from that, taking measures against other countries, you know, other countries won't just sit there. They're likely to retaliate, and we all, you know, end up poorer as a result.
And that's the part, Kai, that I think scrambles a lot of people's brains. It might seem morally like the right thing to do to pressure companies not to move jobs overseas. But then if that's going to mean higher tariffs all the way around, is that actually going to be more jobs for Americans or less jobs for Americans and better standards of living or lower standards of living? And that's where economics gets really complicated.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that the history of the 20th century for America is pretty clear, right? That by insisting upon the shared wealth between the owners of capital and workers, which is the what we're debating here, right? That put more money in workers' pockets. They put more money into the economy, and the economy grew. You know, and that was the 20th century, and the particular form of work and manufacture fell apart. The manufacturing economy fell apart, right? And so now people do different work, and people own different kinds of capital. And the question is, in that world, in a service sector world, which is what our economy is, will we have that same
so
sort of change?
So that's why you come back to the service
that's
sector.
That's why I come back to the
question,
service
but
sector.
But there is a moral economy question that we've been talking about for years, really, and not always with respect to free trade, sometimes with respect to Walmart paying low wages and then importing. It's related to free trade, importing these cheaply made clothes from overseas and things like that. Which is better for society, to have a low wage, low price economy or a higher wage, high price economy? And the progressive position has generally been, let's raise wages, and yeah, things will cost a little more, but people won't be scraping to put food on their children on their plates for their children, even when they have full-time jobs.
Well, currently we have a high-price, low-wage economy, and I think the question is, how do we get out of that? And there is a reason to believe. So again, we can fight over the tariffs, right? Or we can back up to the more basic principle here, which is whether or not the wealth is shared. That really is what the fight is about. And if we put more money in more workers' pockets, then our economy grows. We've seen that. And I worry that this fight over over the history of manufacturing, which is what we're fighting over, and whether it's here or abroad, is not speaking to the fight over money in workers' pockets today.
Listeners, John, and I just want to tell the listeners who are listening in stereo, because a few people are writing to us about it, that we realize but we can't fix between now and the end of this segment that John from The Economist is only in your left channel. So we get it. Just acknowledging it. It's not your device. it's us. And this is not political casting. We're not having John come from the left, you know, to make any kind of a statement. It's just technology. Anyway, John, go ahead.
I'm sorry if that's annoying our listeners. Yeah, I think there are two slightly separate discussions here. Discussion one is, how do we make America as wealthy as possible? And I think the answer to that, looking at the 20th century and before, is fairly clearly, you know, trade is good. Then there's a second discussion, which is, how do we have an economy that's more equal? And then you get into a discussion about redistribution, about, you know, either higher minimum wages or topping up wages through some kind of labor subsidy. But if you're Donald Trump, you don't really want to have discussion number two because you don't want to talk about redistribution. So what you do is give the impression that you can have a much more equal economy through, you know, protectionism, through putting pressure on companies. Unfortunately, I think what's likelier to happen is that, you know, as Rita said earlier, you get prices rise, and that actually hurts the poorest Americans most. So it's sort of self-defeating. I totally understand the appeal of it, but I fear it might be self-defeating.
Laura in Bushwick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm a graduate student in chemistry, and I had built up this kind of hope that I'd be able to work for the federal government in the Department of Interior, specifically applying what I know as a chemist towards conservation and environmental studies. And given the most recent freeze on federal government job hiring, that's kind of in the back burner for now. But in the context of what you guys are speaking, not only is that terrifying to me, a terrifying prospect to me personally, that I won't be able to pursue these kind of jobs that I've been working up towards, but during the campaign, the Trump campaign, there's been this chant of "Make America Great Again," and most people, when they think of it, they think of kind of the American might of post-World War II in the 50s and even the early 60s. But one of the hallmarks of that era was a huge investment on the federal government's part toward research and development on universities and industry and all of that. And that's one of the reasons that led to the huge kind of rise in prosperity, of American prosperity, if you will. And to think that you have politicians who are focusing so narrowly on one specific type of job without thinking about how they can recreate those conditions in a more broad sense by investing in research, by investing in science, is lamentable.
It's a great point. You know, on the hiring freeze, hiring freezes don't last forever as people with needed skills leave. And for you as a grad student in chemistry, that's such a rare skill, that a set of skills, whatever you do with chemistry, that, you know, eventually, if your goal is to work for the federal government, that's my guess is that's probably going to be open to you. But on the broader point, I think we have no idea yet, and it's important, you're right, that we explore this and track him on this, and that people actually include this in the reporting agenda to find out what the research and other science-oriented set of policies is going to be. I'll replay the seven-second clip of Trump just a little while ago after he met with auto executives talking about the environment.
I am, to a large extent, an environmentalist. I believe in it. But it's out of control.
So, Kai, we have no idea yet really what kind of environmentalist, if at all, he's going to be. He also signaled in that appearance that he signaled that he's going to allow the Dakota Pipeline and the Keystone Pipeline to go forward. So there's obviously a skepticism about global warming or how the Obama administration was dealing with global warming, but that doesn't go to everything about Laura's question on basic science.
Yeah, we have absolutely no idea. There is no idea. And even if you look at this environmentalist thing, I mean, part of it is part of the sort of intellectual and political challenge here with everything with this president is that he seems to be just sort of randomly saying things. You know, it is difficult to develop because he's moved, he's shifted us out of a space where our leaders are arguing over a set of coherent values and ideologies, right? Where we can say, this is generally what this person stands for. These are the values he's fighting for. And we can figure out how that might show up in a certain set of policies. He has, by his own description, switched to, this is a series of transactions. This is, we are going to look for transactions. So Where does that go? What does that mean for science investment? What's a good transaction for investment and research?
Right.
Who knows?
Right. And, of course, a test is going to be the actual job creation numbers over time, even on the topics that Trump is talking about, and whether they match the high publicity rollouts like these. So if the TV images don't match the actual job creation numbers, he'll look like a huckster, or the economy could actually change, but only time will tell. My guests are WNYC's Kai Wright and John Prideaux, U.S. editor for The Economist. And let me switch to something else the president did without a direct statement of what it was. He signed three executive orders yesterday in a televised signing ceremony. And let me play the audio of two of the signings to show you a contrast. This is the president with cameras clicking, signing the withdrawal from the TPP. Chief of Staff Reince Priebus speaks first.
All right, we're going to sign three memorandums right now. The first one is withdrawal of the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Everyone knows what that means, right? We've been talking about this for a long time. Thank you. Okay. Great thing for the American worker, what we just did.
Okay. Trump with cameras and words about withdrawing from the TPP. Now here's the signing of the new ban on U.S. aid to any health organization in developing countries that provides or even mentions the option of abortion to women with unwanted pregnancies. This is known as the Mexico City gag rule. Again, Reince Priebus.
Next is the policy in regard to Mexico City.
Well, they don't call it the gag rule for nothing. It was euphemistically introduced by Priebus as just Mexico City, and Trump said nothing as he signed the order. Kai, he could have said, I saw the women marching for women's rights all over the world. Marchers, take that.
Well, yeah, and I think this is part of one of the things we'll see with this administration in terms of threading – trying to put together the priorities of traditional Republicans with the priorities of this White House. And so the global gag rule, as it's
called.
Sort of
the conservatives with the populists,
right,
if you will.
And so this is the new old rule. This has – George Bush signed it on back into order on his first day in office. Obama signed it out on his first day in office. And it's a fight over whether it's another proxy fight in the abortion wars. And so what it does is restrict U.S. funding for international groups that do largely global health from engaging in anything that looks like a promotion of abortion.
I guess this is the new right, because Steve Bannon is kind of the glue here. He's an economic populist who wants to spend more money on infrastructure and keep Medicare and Social Security. It's not a small government right in that respect, but he's also kind of a Catholic religion steeped, Judeo-Christian values are under siege, anti-abortion guy.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is more Mike Pence. This is probably more of a Mike Pence issue. This is something that has been close and dear to
But Pence isn't the economic populist.
Right.
Bannon is who ties together Mike Pence and, you know, this kick the CEOs in the rear and spend money on jobs.
I think so. But it's also a question of how are they going to continue to keep congressional Republicans happy as they do things like sign away TPP that make congressional Republicans unhappy. And this kind of thing is a great way to do
it. So, John, from The Economist, this is a policy, as you know, that has gone back and forth since Reagan announced it as president in Mexico City, which is how it got its nickname, the Mexico City policy. Clinton undid it. George W. Bush put it back. Obama undid it again. And now Trump put it back again. And as we've been hearing, with more stringency, so that these women's health organizations in the developing world that get this U.S. aid, even if they're performing abortions or even advising women that abortions are an option with money that they get from any other source, then those groups will be cut off from U.S. aid. So I guess this is the essential Democratic versus Republican values clash over whether U.S. tax money should be used in any way to subsidize abortion anywhere in the world.
Essential clash, and in a way, that's a rather depressing thing if you've watched American politics for a while. Partly because you look at the abortion rate in America, and it's fallen so far, and yet it's still such an insurmountable obstacle between the two parties. I thought, just going back to your observation about President Trump not saying anything when he signed that executive action, if you watched him during the campaign, he's clearly not an authentic social conservative, and on some issues, you could see him reaching hard to try and imagine what the best social conservative position would be on an issue and coming out with that, and sometimes he got it wrong. So, for example, on the campaign, there was a moment when he said that doctors who performed abortions in America should be imprisoned, and then there was a kind of outcry because that wasn't the right.
And he said women,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
And because he hadn't studied up on the issue yet.
Which was out of step with what the...
That's right.
Because the pro-life movement, quote-unquote...
Exactly,
says don't punish the women.
That he has to, you know, sort of build bridges with those folks. And also in terms of your observation about the way he puts economic populism together with some of these values issues, it's very reminiscent of a kind of European populism that you might see in uh-huh. France or Italy. It's very unusual in American politics.
But I thought the European right doesn't have the American religious element. Am I missing something?
No, I think you're right about that. But in several European countries, no, Britain's not one of them, but you have a large, you know, Catholic majority and abortion, I think somewhere like Poland, has a similar status as it does in America as a kind of cultural touchstone. I think what makes America particularly unusual is that divide. In most other countries where I follow the politics, you know, there are large majorities on either side.
John, are you familiar with the impact of the Mexico City policy when it's in effect, as it's gone back and forth over these many administrations now, versus when it's not over the years on abortion rates or on women's health and poverty rates?
I haven't got into the weeds on this, and it's something I mean to do over the next couple of days. But, I mean, what's certainly the case is we know that under George W. Bush, the American... you know, government's policy on AIDS reduction was extremely effective, particularly in Africa. And presumably anything that makes it harder for women in poor countries to get contraception is going to push in the other direction. But I would need to get into the weeds on that.
Over the years, it has been particularly frustrating to people who do global health of any kind, because it's not really about, for them, it's not really about reproductive rights debates, right? Like if you have any portion of your services that go to reproductive rights, and these organs, you know, oftentimes if you're a clinic in Botswana, you know, you do everything, you know, and so if you do any portion of it that has to do with reproductive rights, your funding is in
jeopardy.
That's
why it's so broad.
And so that is the thing that is frustrating to people in global health, and it really what it amounts to is harassment, right? So people just spend an enormous amount of time and energy and resources figuring out how to restructure themselves such that they can continue their work with U.S. funding. And so the difference between when the policy exists and when the policy doesn't exist is really just how much time is spent providing health care and how much time is spent rewriting weird grants in order to get around the gag.
Yeah, and they're trying to even get them to not even be able to write weird grants to get around the gag rule anymore. And listeners, we'll do a separate segment on this in a coming show because it's important, and it's not well understood in this country because it doesn't actually apply to women in this country. So we will do that as a separate on a subsequent show. I want to thank WNYC's Kai Wright and John Prideaux from The Economist. He's the U.S. editor of The Economist. They are also the co-hosts of the Monday night edition of our new four-night-a-week evening national call-in show called Indivisible. They debuted it for all the world to hear last night in the 8 o'clock hour, and they'll be back the next 13 Mondays, because this series lasts through the first 100 days of the Trump administration. It's the first 100 days evening national call-in series. Again, a reminder that I'll be the Tuesday night host, so I'll be on tonight, and our Tuesday night series will be on changing norms. So join me for that, as my guests tonight will be Fareed Zakaria and Michael Moore. Kai And John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian. Have fun tonight.
And speaking of changing norms, Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post, wrote this weekend that the traditional way of reporting on a president is dead and Press Secretary Sean Spicer killed it. We'll talk to Margaret Sullivan next.